Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Roundtable Plus webinar on Structuring a REIT: Impact of Budget 2014 on the Real Estate Sector. This session is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates. We request you to send your email address to rsvp@nishitdesai.com. To ensure you don't miss out on newsletters and information about future events. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during this conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. The speakers for the call today are Shobhit Agarwal, Managing Director, Capital Markets, Jones Lang LaSalle; Nitin Gupta, Managing Director, Macquarie Capital Advisors India; Nishal Joshipura, Partner, Private Equity and Private Debt, Nishit Desai Associates; Ruchir Sinha, Co-Head, Private Equity and Private Debt Investments, Nishit Desai Associates; Rajesh Simhan, Head, International Tax, Nishit Desai Associates; Deepak Jodhani, Senior Member, Real Estate Practice, Nishit Desai Associates. I would now like to hand the session over to Nishal Joshipura, Private Equity and Private Debt, Nishit Desai Associates. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you. Once again, welcome to all attending in person and on phone. We already have the introduction to the panelists. Now, let me quickly give you a brief overview on what we are going to cover in the session today. Primarily two things. One is the REIT regime for which the new budget has given tax clarity. Whether it's clarity or ambiguity, we'll discuss on the panel. But we are going to discuss the REIT regime. And we are also going to discuss some of the relaxations which have been given by budget with respect to foreign investment in the real estate sector. Let me give you a brief introduction to REIT. Now, what is a REIT and why does India need a REIT regime? A REIT is a vehicle where you pull in money from various investors, both domestic and foreign, institutional and retail. What are the benefits of REIT? Now, as far as India is concerned, the biggest benefit of a REIT is it will further develop the Indian capital market. What India has done successfully till date has been India has always been exporting its capital markets to foreign countries. Today, if you want to list a IT software company, everybody looks at NASDAQ. If you want to list mines or mineral assets, everybody looks at LSE or AIM market. When it comes to real estate assets, hospitals, toll bridge, FGX is the market to list. So India has not developed any niche for itself as far as its capital markets are concerned. And hence, the REIT regime is extremely important for India to further develop the capital market. So that's one reason why India needs a REIT regime. Second biggest reason is to bring more transparency in the real estate sector. As we all know, the transparency in the Indian real estate sector is not as much as is desired or as much as we see in the developed countries. With REIT regime and with experts managing the REIT assets, it is expected that there will be more transparency in the real estate sector. There will be more governance, which would be there, which is something which is the biggest concern of foreign investors in India. And with the REIT regime, some of those concerns should get addressed. The third major benefit of the REIT regime is a retail investor will be able to participate in the income generating assets. That also reduces the risk for the retail investor because as compared to under construction properties, where you don't know when you will get your returns back, at least in rental generating properties, you know that there is a steady flow of rental income through which the unit holders will be regularly paid some amount at a periodic interval. So that's another big advantage of a REIT regime. The fourth major advantage is it will give exit, which is something which all the investors want. They want to exit from the project. So existing, a lot of investors have invested in existing commercial projects or income generating projects. And there is no avenue to exit, because for foreign investors, unless it's an industrial park or an asset which qualifies for FDI, foreign investors cannot buy a direct income generating asset, and typically these assets are of huge size and no Indian fund has a wherewithal to acquire such assets. So a lot of foreign investors are stuck with their assets in India and they don't know how to exit. With REITs coming in, it will be a good way of monetizing some of these core assets and distributing the returns to the LPs. Now, as far as international REIT regime is concerned, we have many countries which have introduced the REIT regime. USA has a REIT regime, UK introduced the REIT regime in 2007. We have Singapore, we have Malaysia, Hong Kong. And you'll be surprised to know that Nigeria and Pakistan also have a listed REIT regime. So that's the last thing which, you know, the Indian government would want. And that could also be one of the reasons why there is so much of hurry in introducing the REIT regime and providing tax clarity for the REITs. Now, what have been the efforts which have been made by SEBI? It's not that SEBI has just started working on REITs. SEBI has been working on REITs since 2008, when it first introduced the draft REIT regulation. Unfortunately, that never saw the light of the day because of various issues. So what SEBI did and what was actually expected was that the draft REIT regulations in 2008 will be converted into final REIT regulations. But that never happened. So that was the first failed attempt of SEBI to introduce the REIT regime in India. What SEBI did was it introduced real estate mutual fund regulations. But the problem with those regulations, there were two or three major issues. The first issue was that a real estate mutual fund can only hold assets which are free from encumbrances and free from litigation. Now, to have such type of asset in India is something that is almost next to impossible. So this was one of the major reasons why it didn't take off. Another major reason was there was a requirement to publish the NAV on a daily basis of real estate mutual fund. Now, with an illiquid asset like real estate, it's not practically possible to publish the NAV on a daily basis. There are also certain issues on tax. So because of some of these major issues, in spite of the fact that we have real estate mutual fund regulations, the regime never took off. Since the last 1 year, SEBI has been making a lot of efforts, and we have been involved with SEBI in, you know, drafting the REIT regulations. And it's commendable the pace with which SEBI is moving. SEBI wants to introduce this regulation. They have been talking to Ministry of Finance, and the stage was almost set in last December for introduction of the REIT regime. Unfortunately, what happened was the REIT regime wouldn't have taken off without a tax clarity, and the tax clarity could have been provided only by the new government. So this entire REIT regime was shelved in last December with an indication that when the new government comes, you know, the regime will be introduced by the new government. So broadly, this is how right now we are. We have tax clarity under the budget. SEBI has already issued draft REIT regulations. What we will do today is we will discuss what are the challenges under the draft REIT regulations of SEBI, what are the challenges under the tax proposals presented by the finance minister, and what are the other commercial issues surrounding it. So my first question will be to Shobhit. Do you think the REIT regime is going to be a game changer for the real estate industry in India?
We definitely hope so. Where we are today, and, you know, sometimes timing is very important. Of course, 2008 was a good attempt, but frankly, today it's more appropriate because in the physical market, we are ready with those assets. And I think 2005 is when we opened FDI. We started building better quality assets. They're now operational. We recently did a study ourselves, you know, just to, and that also was sort of commenced because that we wanted it, on what is the total quantity of these, or what could be the size. And, you know, there's about 350 million square feet of grade A assets, as we call it. start filtering it from a REIT perspective, we sort of narrowed it down to about 100 million square feet. This is, and when I'm saying filtering it, these are top seven cities, these are top quality assets, but the filters were whether this is institutionally held, and what we mean is single ownership.
Right. So in a lot of our, in our country, to monetize office assets, the only way was to sell floor-wise or start a back lit. But companies like DLF, who continue to hold these assets in balance sheet, set the stage. Today, there are multiple such office developers. And these are zonal developers, so I won't call them pan-India. DLF has a lot of stock in NCR. There's another developer called Panchil in Pune who has some things in this embassy, who has Bangalore. So if you club their assets, it sort of comes to about 100 million square feet. This is all well tenanted. This is stabilized. It's income generating. There is historical data points. I would think tenants love it because there's certain stickiness, either because the rents are low or the building is very good. Also, by default, when they started building in 2005, these were perhaps peripheral assets. Today, the cities have expanded so fast that these have become almost in-city assets and therefore very difficult to replace, right? I may be able to build something more, but I cannot build it in that location. And therefore, there is occupier satisfaction, right? Today, I can give you cheaper assets in Noida, Greater Noida, but nobody wants to go there because there's enough and more in Gurgaon. So given all of that, I think we are now sort of REIT ready, if I might use that word. So from a timing perspective, I think it works well. Of course, there is other reasons where we are finding that investors, both Indian and foreign investors, now they have a flight to safety. They don't want to take development risk. There was a point in time where they were mad about IRRs. Everybody wanted 25% developing nation, higher expectations. They really figured out that the risk there is much more than they can actually use. And therefore, they're saying, it's okay, we take lower risk. We go into stabilized assets, but we make decent returns there. So I think from appetite perspective also now, there is more demand for stabilized assets. And it's a global trend, not just India. Of course, India is more pronounced because of our currency issue. But globally, people are just buying stabilized assets. So REITs everywhere are swelling up because that's the way investors prefer it. For several reasons, and one of them is that there's an assured sort of return coming to you. You are okay with it. So even when you look at REIT, because we are aiming or we're hoping the total return, both income and appreciation, will ultimately lead to about a mid-teen, 14-15%. I think there should be a big interest and appetite, and therefore we think it will be a game changer. We estimate there will be about $8-9 billion of listing. Should it start now from the date of listing, let's say 2 years, first listing, it will swell to about $8-9 billion. And both, we think that there's appetite both domestically and internationally.
That's quite encouraging. Nitin, you have been involved with many fundraising from offshore investors. Do you think they would be interested in investing in an Indian REIT?
Sure. Just before I answer this question, I think look at the history of REITs globally. REITs as an asset class has been in existence for over five decades. US was the first country way back in 1960s when they introduced the REIT framework, followed by markets like Australia, and then various other countries sort of enacted REIT laws. Asia was a bit late. It started in Japan in about 2000 or so, and followed by Singapore and Hong Kong. In fact, India is quite late. It's the eighth Asian market to introduce a REIT. Perhaps Philippines is the only market which doesn't have REIT at this point of time. Otherwise, all major markets within Asia have REIT laws. If you look at the global market cap of REITs, it's about $2 trillion. Asia constitutes about 15% of that, almost like sort of a $200 billion invested in Asian REITs at this point of time. So investors, I think, have been sort of loving this asset class. Especially large pension funds who have a requirement of sort of earning sort of stable yield over a long period to meet their own pension liabilities. They tend to invest heavily in a REIT and they look for markets which are transparent, which are developed, and then can provide them a stable returns over a long period. We certainly feel that, sort of as Shobhit was saying, we have come a long way since 2005 when first FDI was allowed in real estate in India, and the market has matured a lot since then. And we are sort of a REIT-ready market at this point of time. A few things to be done, but I think there are a few players who can go to the market and tap into institutional capital. So capital is available in abundance for this product. It's just a matter of how we structure it and how we sort of show a sort of a that the key parameters like transparency, governance, growth are all offered to the investors in a manner which is comparable to the other markets which are competing with India. So long as we are able to demonstrate that, I think money is available in plenty.
Sure. So Deepak has Nitin mentioned that the structure is the key for REIT. There is interest in India, but how much is the net IRR which the investor will get? That will be the key for any foreign investor or even a domestic investor to invest in a REIT. Now, my question to you is, we have SEBI's draft regulation. Can you briefly touch upon what would be a typical structure of the REIT and what are the salient features of the draft REIT regulation? For the benefit of the audience, this will be a typical REIT structure, and the participants attending on phone, we had sent a hotline a few days back, and that hotline has the structure of the REIT. So if you want, you can refer to that structure.
Sure. So the draft REIT regulations came out in October 2013, and the last date for comments was 31st October 2013. We also given our comments to the draft REIT regulations. There are a few issues which we'll be discussing in this session. But before that, just a brief snapshot of how the REIT is proposed to be set up under the draft REIT regulations. Now, unlike the AIF, where even a company or a body corporate or an LLP can be set up as an AIF, the draft REIT regulations contemplate only a trust to be set up as a REIT. Now, this trust, all the units of the trust have to be mandatory listed. There is no time frame prescribed for the trust, because unlike AIF, where the intention or the idea is to make the investment and then realize the investment and then give the returns back to the investors, because REITs are proposed to make investments only in yield-generating assets, and there is no time frame within which the exit has to be given to the investors, so there is no period for the REIT, and all the REITs are proposed to be set up as perpetual REITs. Now, who will be the parties involved in the REIT? There are mainly four parties which will be there in the REIT structure. First is the sponsor, second is the trustee, third is the manager, and fourth is the valuer. Apart from that, we also have your, stock exchanges, auditors, depositories, typical intermediaries involved for listing of REIT units. But these will be the four main parties to the REIT. Now, let's take each one of them. So, first is the sponsor. Now, sponsor is the person who will be setting up the REIT. This is going to be either the developer or the fund who is going to own the asset, and he is going to throw the asset into the REIT pool. Now, the role of the sponsor, there are not primarily many obligations of the sponsor under the REIT regime. Main role of the sponsor is just to have skin in the game. There is a lock-in period, and there is a minimum unit holding which the sponsor has to have. Apart from that, there are not many obligations which is imposed on the sponsor. And the net worth, there are certain qualification requirements which the sponsor has to have. One is he has to have at least 20 crores worth of net worth on a consolidated basis in terms of net worth requirement. Second is, in terms of qualification, he has to have at least 5 years of experience on an individual basis. So if he complies with these two qualification requirements, any person can set up the REIT. Next comes the trustee. Now, this is not the usual trustee which you find in your typical NCDDs or your AIF. Here, the trustee has been given wide powers and also wide responsibilities. So, the trustee is the person who will be holding the assets in its own name as for the benefit of the unit holder. Now, the main requirement is that he has to be registered with the debenture trustee regulation, and he should not be a person associated with the sponsor. That is one of the main criteria. Now, in terms of obligations, there are a lot of obligations which have been imposed on the trustee. First is, a trustee has to ensure the legal and marketable title to the property. That is one, which typically should have been in the case of managers. Second is that he has to supervise the manager's function. Now, the manager, whether he is investing as per the investment conditions, whether he is making the timely distributions or not, whether he is addressing the grievances of the investors. So these are all the important functions which the trustee has to, you know, play in this REIT structure. And at least not more than 50% of the directors of the REIT or of the trustee can be associated to the REIT. So that is the trustee. Now third is the manager. Manager is the most important player in this REIT design. He is the one who will be identifying all the investment opportunities, and the final decision as to which property to invest in, whether to sell, to whom to lease, will all be given, will be played by the manager. Now, unlike a trustee or a valuer, where it is clearly provided that they cannot be an associate of the sponsor, in case of manager, there is no such requirement. So manager, you know, there is an ambiguity, but still could be an associate of the sponsor. It is just that the investment committee, so manager has to form an investment committee of not less than 5 members. At least 50% of the investment committee should not be related party to the REIT. That is how they try to, you know, keep that impartiality within the manager. Now he is going, manager is the person who is going to run the IPO process. He is going to manage the property. He is going to maintain the property. He is going to coordinate with all the intermediaries, appoint the valuers, appoint the auditors. So all the functions of the REIT will be taken by the manager. Now in terms of manager also, there is certain minimum requirement. The managers cannot, the minimum net worth requirement of the manager has to be 5 crores. So manager by definition has to be a company. So there are qualifications in terms of both. The manager has to have a qualification, minimum net worth of 5 crores. And in terms of experience, the requirement is at both manager level and the personal level. So at the manager level, there's a requirement of 5 years experience in either fund management or advisory services in terms of real estate or actual development of real estate. And similar requirement is also imposed on at least 2 key employees of the manager. So both the criteria have to be met. Now fourth is the valuer. Now valuer also plays a very important role. So there is a principal valuer which has to be appointed by the REIT. Now unlike the RMF regime which Nishal mentioned, where the NAV has to be given out on a daily basis. So what they have done here is the NAV will be calculated by the manager, but the valuation has to be done twice a year. Once it has to be, the full valuation has to be done once every year, and on a half yearly basis, an updating valuation can be done by the valuer. And there are again guidelines prescribed by the valuer as to which guidelines he should be adopting while, and there are certain transparency and impartiality thresholds also prescribed for the valuer. So those are the intermediaries. Now coming to how the REIT is going to raise the money. So REIT is going to come up with an IPO or a follow-on offer to raise the money. And the third is they can also raise the money by way of debt. Now before it can make an IPO, so there are two or three conditions which the REIT has to satisfy. First is the REIT assets should be at least worth 1,000 crores. So REIT cannot have less than 1,000 crores worth of assets. It is not necessary that it has to have 4 or 5 assets. Even a single asset could be worth 1,000 crores. Unlike AIF, where there is a requirement of, you know, you cannot invest more than 25% in a single SPV or a single asset. So there is no condition, no such condition here. Second is the offer to the public has to be at least worth 25% of the total value of the REIT, so that the public float is maintained. And third is the offer size should be at least 250 crores. So that those three conditions, if they are met, then the REIT can go for initial public offering. Now, in terms of investors, the tradable lot has been prescribed as 1 lakh. And at the time of subscription, the minimum subscription has to be at least 2 units or at least 2 lakh rupees has to be subscribed. Units have to be listed within 15 days of from the date of closure, and they have to be allotted also within 15 days. So those are the money raising. In terms of leverage, a REIT can leverage up to 25% of the value of the REIT without any approval. Beyond 25%, it can go for approval of the unit holders and obtain a credit rating and leverage and take the REIT. Now, there are two or three conditions for the REIT to sustain. One is that minimum public float has to be 25% throughout the tenure of the REIT. That is one. And second, at least 20 investors have to be there. Non-sponsor investors have to be there during the course of the REIT. If these two conditions are not met, then the REIT will be required to be delisted. So these are the conditions for raising money. Now coming to investment, as to where the REIT can invest. So the draft regulations provide that REIT can invest directly in the real estate assets also, and it can also invest in an SPV which holds the real estate assets. So that flexibility has been provided. But the investment has to be made in a security or a or the real estate asset. We'll come to the challenges as to, you know, what challenges arise out of the use of the word security later. Now, if it is investing in SPV, what SEBI wants is that it should not be holding many minority interest in the SPV. REIT should have full control over the SPV. So at least 51% of the SPV should be held by the REIT. And the other 49% or the other minority shareholder, they should not have any right which restricts the REIT from fulfilling its obligations under the drafted regulation. So that two conditions have to be clearly met before the REIT can invest in the SPV. Now, the main function of the REIT is to invest in yield-generating assets. So the condition imposed by SEBI is that at least 90% of the REIT value has to be invested in rent-generating assets. It could be direct or through an SPV. Now, what do we mean by rent-generating? Rent-generating means at least 75% of that rent-generating property should be leased out. So they are given a buffer of 25%. The 25%, because the market conditions, you know, could be sometimes lying vacant, but at least 75% of the rent-generating asset has to be leased out. REIT cannot invest in vacant land or agricultural land. Now, for the remaining 10%, SEBI has granted leeway to some extent. They can invest in developmental assets. They can invest in listed, non-convertible, listed or unlisted NCDs. They can invest in listed equity, which derives their value from real estate. They can invest in government securities, etc. So these are the investment conditions for REIT. Now, in terms of repatriation, REIT is mandatorily required to repatriate 90% of the income after tax to the unit holders by way of dividend. So it cannot hold on to the money for further investment. 90% of the profits, net profits, have to be repatriated back to the investors. So those are the investment and repatriation conditions. Now, one of the main conditions, or one of the essential requirements for SEBI, or the, you know, concerns for SEBI, is that how is the investor protected? So they have also built in a lot of investor protections here. So many items in terms of in the REIT regime have been required to be, they have to be mandated, required to be approved by the investors, by the unit holders. So in certain cases, the requirement is that 60% of the unit holders by value and number have to approve, and in certain cases, at least 75% have been mandated. For example, if you are doing a related party transaction, and this is primarily for related party transaction, because SEBI's concern was that, you know, the investor should not be fooled by using related party mechanism. So there are certain thresholds prescribed. So for a related party transaction, at least 75% of the unit holders have to approve. So, and for change in manager, change in sponsor, all these conditions, again, the unit holder's consent is required. Now, one last point, in terms of related party, whenever there is a transaction, one is the principal value which will be doing the valuation. To protect the unit holders, what SEBI has prescribed is there is a requirement of secondary valuer. Now, both the valuers will do the valuation. You take the average. And average will be the benchmark. So if the REIT is buying property, you cannot buy property more than the average. If it is selling the property, you cannot sell the property below the average. So that is how they have tried to protect the investors.
Thanks, Deepak. As we can see, SEBI has put in a lot of effort in drafting the REIT regulations, and they've almost got it right, which is unlike some of the other legislations which we see. However, with each legislation, there are always certain reasons which need to be ironed out. So my next question is to Ruchir. Ruchir, you have been involved actively with SEBI in drafting of the REIT regulation as part of the APRIA committee. Would you like to throw some light on what has been SEBI's mindset on the REIT regime, and what are the challenges which SEBI will need to ensure that, you know, they are corrected before they finalize the REIT regulation?
Sure. I think just before that, many of you have these plastic folders, which has an article of Bloomberg. So that sets out some of the challenges that we figure out and our recommendations to the SEBI. For those on call, the Bloomberg article was attached in the invite. So I think they can look at that. It quite comprehensively covers the issues and the challenges in the, you know, in the REIT regulations and how do we see them evolve. I think purely from a SEBI perspective, initial drivers have largely been covered by what you initially said. I think I think there were primarily three drivers. First, SEBI's primary intent is to protect retail investors. And I think there are many schemes today that are prevailing in the real estate space. And SEBI is not really entirely able to protect the interests of these retail investors. And therefore, they were the mindset to provide an asset-backed investment opportunity with established revenue streams. And it's the Indian mindset, right? Feeding the essential investment in gold, investment in real estate, and probably marriage. So within those three things, people like to exploit every opportunity of real estate investment. And sometimes they're protected, sometimes they're not. And REITs will essentially give you asset-backed investment, establish revenue stream because 90% has to entirely be dividended out. The other issue was, of course, export of capital markets, and I think Singapore has been coming up as an excellent opportunity for Indian real estate to list. And I think that will probably be a concern. I mean, Nitin and Shobhit will probably answer later also, that even now, after the REIT regime coming in, will Singapore still offer better valuations, right? So I think that was another part. Third was just like gold and real estate both, you know, have a lot of cash involvement, etc. So these investments were not GDP accretive. So even though you know, a lot of investments were being made, it was not getting reflected in the economy. So I think that was another driver for this. From a foreign investment perspective, and I think that's where you know, RBI has been also you know, looking at this very favorably. We've had discussions with them, and they've tried to you know, relax certain restrictions which they have with investment completed asset release. And the driver for them and the MOM has been that real estate has largely been the largest real estate infra, the largest absorbers for investment, and you really need to open them. And in fact, as Shobhit said, the demand today is not for developmental assets, but for core assets. So there is a need to allow developers and everyone to monetize on their core assets and allow the investors an opportunity. And of course, there's a huge section of pension funds and insurance, etc., which have large amount of allocation to direct real estate or to REITs. And I think we can, you know, we can capitalize on that. We're already having the Canadian pension funds and teachers fund, etc., which has been arising. So I guess those are really the broad drivers. And I think just one thing which is not really REIT, but is a discussion that is happening at the MOF circles, is that is there a requirement now to open up the entire commercial real estate, right, for foreign investment? Today, no amount of foreign investment, whether direct or portfolio, is allowed in what we call as real estate business. And real estate business is defined to mean anything which is not developmental activity. So long as the moment the asset gets completed, there is no amount of foreign investment which is allowed. So I think there is a need today, which is felt at the MOF and everywhere, that you need to differentiate between residential and commercial. When you're coming in residential, there is an element of speculation involved, could be. But when you're coming in commercial real estate, like suppose you're investing in warehouses, a mall, you are as good as a service providing company. So there is no speculative activity for which the entire restriction really came up. So you should open that up. And I think that thought process which is coming up, and I think soon you will see the commercial real estate space opening up as well, right? I think clearly in terms of challenges, Deepak quite well explained how the REIT regime, etc., works. I think the biggest challenge that I see is the track record of the sponsor. The REIT regulations say that sponsors should have a 5-year real estate industry track record. Now, this kind of restricts the entire REIT regime to only the developer-based assets, right? You might have education REITs, you might have hospital REITs, hotel REITs, etc. Those have completely been ruled out, because what would you do then, right? Suppose there's a hospital, let's say Walkart, it could transfer their real estate to a REIT, and from that REIT, you know, they could just take the property on lease. So it's for both purposes. But now, because Walkart would not have real estate experience or real estate industry experience, it is completely discarded. So you've completely narrowed down this to only the developer category. Then again, on an attendant point, related party transactions have been restricted to only 20%, right? So if you're a sponsor of a REIT, you can't lease out more than 20% of the area or by value. So again, sponsor, you know, again, the same situation like hospitality REIT, hotel REIT, etc., are totally out, or educational REIT, you know, there have been a lot of interest from them. But I think, and this is something which has been purposely put up by SEBI. So in our discussions, they were very particular that at the initial go, we want only, because people would invest on the name of these sponsors. So they want obligations on everyone. This is probably the most conservative regime which you would see coming. It has got takeover code-like protections, which were not there in REMF and other regimes. It has got stringent obligations on the trustee. It has got stringent obligations on the manager. It has also got obligations on the sponsor, right? So I think that is the kind of restrictive, element that we should, and hopefully it should be relaxed, you know, in times to come. The other challenge which I see from a regulatory perspective is that the manager and the key managerial personnel both need to have a track record. Now, the manager might be a new entity, and it will typically be a new entity unless you purchase. Now, that may not always happen. So, like, that may also be a non-starter. So, that also probably needs to be changed. The trustee's obligations are extensive. To say that a trustee will give a fit and proper title certificate or the trustee will give business certificate may not work. these some of these obligations, and Deepak elaborately mentioned them, should be passed on to the manager, and trustee should only largely play a supervisory function. Again, in terms of voting, it is said that there are certain times 60% threshold, 75% threshold, and this is non-interested party basis thresholds. But this is not a present and voting basis. So you need to find out every person to pass a matter, right? That's one point. Second is its value and number. So even one unit holder is equal to person holding a substantial value of REITs. I think 75% area, there was a lot of debate, you know, that how can you really determine, because there's a requirement that for rent generating classification, your 75% area must be leased out. Now, that's a market function. Sometimes you may have it, sometimes you may not, and I think we went through a lot of debate. But turns out that is fine, but there is no cure period given. So if one day also you're gone, you straight away go for delisting. So I think there has to be a mechanism over 6 to 12 months of a leeway, that if you, if the market function, you go down, you should be given. There is no cure period anywhere by the way in these REIT regulations. Again, I think from a valuation perspective, there are severe issues. Because what they've said is that valuation has to be as per internationally accepted standards or ICAI. And in case of conflict, ICAI prevails. Now, the question is, and there are many people here, Hardeep, you've done a lot of research on REITs and valuations, etc. The question is that, is ICAI the appropriate body for valuing real estate? It's a very different animal altogether. Then I think 90% has been said that you must dividend that out. I think from a tax perspective, Rajesh may cover, it shouldn't always be dividend because a lot of investors will be foreign. So dividend income will have a different classification as against capital gains. So if it is, if you redeem the unit in the home jurisdiction, let's say Singapore, etc., where capital gains are exempt, you might get some benefits. So I think the language should be changed to say that dividends or other appropriate mechanism for distribution or something like that. And I think the last important thing is, from a partnership perspective. Today, many of these real estate assets could be housed in partnership from a tax optimization perspective. A general partnership has been completely ruled out because they've said that you can only invest in bodies corporate. Partnership would not be a body corporate. A limited liability partnership will be a body corporate under the LLP Act. But the LLP Act itself says that the members of a limited liability partnership can only be a body corporate or an individual. The question then comes up is that, is the trust a body corporate? Probably answer is no. Now, many people may take a view that it's a trustee which is the legal and beneficial owner, and therefore it can be. But many trustees here are not comfortable becoming, in fact, ILFS in the, this has been about 18, 20 months of discussions with every stakeholder, and ILFS very clearly said that we are not comfortable becoming members of an LLP because that would violate. So I think these are some of the issues. These regulations obviously need, they will go through another iteration. For those of you who are interested, we can send you our recommendations that we made. Many of them should be implemented and accepted. But I think there's still time, and I think it should be smoothened out.
Thanks, Tochev. As I mentioned, the success of REIT depends on the tax proposal, right? Because ultimately, the investor will be looking at the net IRR which is getting from India. This is the third attempt of SEBI to introduce the REIT regime. And it all depends on tax proposals. If the government fails this time, it will be worse than Brazil's defeat. Right? So, Rajesh, my next question is to you. Do you think that the tax proposals presented by the finance minister will give a boost to the REIT regime?
I think the way I look at it is that, well, they have made a good start, though not necessarily, they didn't necessarily get it perfect. When we're looking at a typical REIT structure, which I think Deepak has gone into, you're looking at a tax consequence at three different levels. One is at the sponsor level, in terms of how is the sponsor going to be taxed at the initial time when the assets are being transferred to the REIT. The second is the taxation at the REIT level. And when I talk about taxation at the REIT level, it's both the REIT and in case it has investments through a SPV or if it holds assets directly, in both situations, how would the tax consequence really work? And the third one is the tax consequence in the hands of the unit holder. Traditionally, across a lot of the different countries where they have a REIT regime in place, they usually have an absolute pass-through that is there in most situations. India has not gone down the path of an absolute pass-through. there is a partial path through that, that we have really gone towards. But just to try and break this up, the first one is at the sponsor level taxation. What the government had done was really to introduce a provision to say that if the sponsor is transferring shares of the SPV, which houses the asset, to the REIT, there is a specific exemption that is provided to the sponsor at the time of transfer to the REIT, with the caveat that subsequently, if the sponsor transfers the units of the REIT, which he has got in exchange for the transfer of the SPV, that is going to be taxed at normal rate, and the sponsor will not get the benefit of undertaking a transaction through the stock exchange mechanism, which in case of long-term capital gains, other unit holders can really enjoy, whereby they don't really have to pay any long-term capital gains tax, but only securities transaction. So that, from a sponsor perspective, there's this huge issue that's going to be there, that yes, I have transferred the SPV, the shares of the SPV to the REIT today, but tomorrow when I'm subsequently disposing off, I am put on a worse off situation as compared to any other unit holder. Having said that, today, one of the things which I think we've been internally debating and discussing also is that even absent a specific exemption provision for transfer of the shares of the SPV to the REIT in exchange for units, since the REIT is set up as a trust, the Income Tax Act provides for exemptions which are there when any person settles the irrevocable trust, or if it is a revocable trust, the transaction is not regarded as a transfer in the first place. So even absent the specific exemption that is there, a sponsor today can technically still rely on either of these provisions depending on the nature of the trust or how it is actually determined. To my mind, it would probably be an irrevocable trust to say that when the sponsor actually settles the trust, that ought not to be taxed under a specific exemption because it is not regarded as a transfer. And if I go down that path to say that since I'm not relying on the specific exemption, which is there for the REIT, when the sponsor subsequently sells the shares, whether he can then take the benefit which is available in respect of sale of units on this floor of the stock exchange. So that is one aspect which is there as far as the sponsor is concerned. Having said that, the other issue for the sponsor also is that there is no specific provision today where if the sponsor is directly holding the assets and not really holding the assets through a SPV, the transfer of those assets to the REIT, there is no specific exemption provision. So if we have a situation where the sponsor decides to transfer the building to the REIT directly and have the REIT directly hold the assets, that today is not an exempt transaction. The only way you can really get around it is to see whether you can rely on the general exemption on settlement of an irrevocable trust or the revocable trust tax exemption to try and see whether the transaction can be characterized as not being taxed. The second aspect is as to the taxation of the REIT. And as I said, there is a partial pass-through mechanism. So there are two situations that are possible. Either the REIT directly holds the assets, or the REIT holds shares and debt of an SPV. If the REIT directly holds assets, in that case, any income of the REIT is effectively going to be charged at a maximum marginal rate that's going to be there. Obviously, if it is income from, since if the REIT is directly holding the assets, this may qualify as income from house property. You will be entitled to the standard deductions, and if there are debt payments that are being made, you're going to be entitled for deductions as far as that is concerned. So there is going to be a single layer of tax that's going to be there, which will be there at the level of the REIT. There is not going to be any tax that's going to be imposed in the hands of the investor in respect of any distributions which are made by the REIT in situations where the REIT is directly holding assets. The second situation is where the REIT is holding shares and debt of the SPV. As far as the shares are concerned, if the REIT gets dividends, there is going to be a tax that's going to be imposed in the hands of the SPV, which is a normal dividend distribution tax that is there. There is not going to be any tax that's going to be there in the hands of the REIT. And there's not going to be any tax that's going to be there in the hands of the investors. One of the big challenges, and I know that a lot of representation was made around this, was really that if the SPV was really distributing dividends to the REIT, that there ought not to be any tax in the hands of the SPV in the nature of dividend distribution tax, just to have a single layer corporate tax in the hands of the SPV and no further tax on distribution to the REIT.
And that's how it is in many jurisdictions.
Which is there in many other jurisdictions, and at least the government at this point in time has not really taken on that particular suggestion. The second is that if the REIT is selling the shares of the SPV, normal corporate tax, 20%, 30%, depending on short-term or long-term, that's going to be there. That is on the shareholding in the SPV. And in both of these situations, there is not going to be any further tax in the hands of the investor at the time of distribution. The last one is really the interest coupon, which can be there in respect of payouts to the REIT. And when I talk about partial pass-through, this is really the only place where there's a pass-through that's allowed. In all other cases, what they have done is we are going to have a single layer tax. In case of an interest payout by the SPV to the REIT, there is not going to be any tax that's going to be imposed in hands of the REIT. What is going to be happening is that when the REIT makes a distribution to the investor, there is going to be a tax in the hands of the investor. But the REIT will withhold taxes at the time of distribution. If it is a distribution that is made to a domestic investor, the REIT will deduct a 10% tax. The resident investor will pay taxes as per his normal personal or corporate tax rates that are there. If it is a payout that is made to a non-resident investor, there is going to be a 5% withholding tax that will be imposed by the REIT, and this will be the final tax. So there will not be any further tax that will be imposed as far as the non-resident investor is concerned. Obviously, today there are, for a non-resident investor, one of the key questions that's always going to be that's going to arise is what is the overall tax consequence? Because today, any investor who's investing from abroad, whether it is US, Singapore, they're going to be looking at the post-tax returns, and which was Nishchal's point, that investors' concern is on the post-tax returns, not the pre-tax returns. So, and there, you're not only looking at tax consequence in India, but also what will be the tax consequence in the home jurisdiction of the investor. As far as India is concerned, it's clear there's going to be a 5% withholding tax on the interest payout. But in the home jurisdiction of the investor, one of the key questions that's going to arise is that is the REIT going to be looked at as a blocker entity, which means that I'm going to recognize the REIT as a separate entity, or is the REIT going to be looked at as a pass-through entity? The reason why this becomes important is that if it is a pass-through entity where I ignore the presence of the REIT and it is as if the investor is holding the assets directly, then he has the ability to get credit for any taxes that were paid by the REIT. And keep in mind that the REIT has paid tax in respect of capital gains. The REIT has paid tax in respect of any income, which if it was directly holding the assets or lease rentals, management fee, the REIT has paid 30% tax on that. So if the REIT is treated as a pass-through entity and not deemed to be in existence for the home jurisdiction of the non-resident investor, then he has the ability to get a credit of all of these taxes. And that actually determines as to what his overall tax consequences. And since we are in a situation where, as I said, it's a partial pass-through, if it was an absolute pass-through, then this question probably would not have arisen. Because then you could have gone in and said, well, the home jurisdiction will probably recognize this as a pass-through entity. So therefore, the non-resident investor will only look at what is the overall quantum, whether it's capital gains, the characterization of the income is going to be the same, whether it is going to be income from other sources, business income, interest income, or capital gains. But that is not going to be the case now because of this partial pass-through mechanism that we have really got in place. The last aspect when you're talking about the investor is really at the time of, as far as the investors are concerned, if they're holding the, since these are units that are traded on the stock exchange, short-term capital gains, long-term capital gains, one of the two can clearly arise. If it's long-term and you're talking about a three-year holding period, pay STT, no further tax. Short-term, you're going to have the normal short-term capital gains. So that is broadly the schematics when we are looking at the tax consequence of the REIT. So as I said, just to summarize, sponsor has a couple of big ticket items in terms of the fact that he is not entitled to a beneficial rate at the time of subsequent transfer of units of the REIT, and no benefits as far as transfer of the direct assets into the REIT. As far as the investors are concerned, domestic investors, well, they're going to have the 30% tax rate, which I don't know whether they'll be too happy about. But having said that, well, since they are domestic investors, in any event, that ought to have been the normal rate, even if they're holding holding the assets directly. Non-resident investors have a big question mark as to what is the characterization of a REIT, whether it's a pass-through or whether it's a blocker entity, which will really determine their overall tax consequence, and whether then on a post-tax basis, whether the REIT actually is an inviting prospect or not. I think that's broadly the overall schematic.
I think from that perspective, you might now, if you've got more of foreign investors, you might like to find ways to inject debt into the SSPV to kind of optimize your returns, right? The point, the challenge should also come into REITs is that if you inject debt to achieve tax optimization of lower 5% withholding and ultimate tax, what does the REIT do with that? Right, so you will have to put in that money into the REIT and then do a cap reduction of some sort to retire the equity. So I think those kind of optimized structures, and there are various alternatives which we can look at. So well, the regime is not that good, but you can find solutions around it.
Shobhit, my next question is to you. We were discussing yesterday about the fact that there are a lot of banks and corporates who are sitting on a number of completed assets. And as Ruchir mentioned, that the sponsor eligibility criteria is that the sponsor should be having experience of 5 years in real estate industry. What do you think? One is the demand for such type of assets as far as the corporates are concerned or the banks are concerned. And second is, do you think this will be a challenge given the fact that none of the sponsors in the form of banks or corporates will be having this track record in the real estate industry?
Absolutely right. I think banks have been knocking and they've been trying to understand the REIT regulations. We've interacted with some of the public sector banks, including large ones like this, FBI, and Rabat Bank. They are sitting on over 4,000 branches, regional offices, headquarters, including the post office, actually. And globally, there are specified REITs like post office REITs or banks. A is large amounts of money that can be unlocked through monetization of their real estate, and they are obviously looking at PropCo versus OpCo, right? So they're on the list of PropCo and the sale and leaseback, which is a fairly strong cash flow. They are in discussion, I think, to see whether or not they can get an exception in case it's a bank. Or otherwise, they will then have to find a partner in organizations and companies that are already operating REITs. So, for example, I think we met the ARA guys, they're one of the largest Singapore REITs. They're looking at this opportunity closely to see whether or not they can partner and they can become the manager while bank can remain as the first team. So that sort of alignment has been looked at, but very early. And of course, other than that, there are Indian corporates which love to own their estate, Infosys and Wipro of the world. And they have a lot of value that they can unlock. So they're also evaluating it, but they're obviously, the challenge is much more for them because they're not really public sector entities. So let's see how government reacts. But that opportunity is equally large. However, like Richard mentioned, that this is primarily focused at developers stroke investors and not at corporate stroke owners of other land banks. The railways can be one big opportunity, but it's too early. We are all trying to see whether they can come. And they themselves are trying to evaluate it. I think it'll come.
Deepak, would you quickly like to summarize which are the other budget proposals impacting foreign investment?
Sure. So one is the REIT. Apart from the REIT, the government, in line with their message that they, Modi's message that he wants to have housing for everyone, each one by 2022. They have also proposed certain relaxation
in terms of FDI and low-cost housing.
So one, what they've done is they've reduced the requirement of 50,000 square meters for an FDI compliant project to 20,000 square meters. Now, this was a major challenge because in, you know, tier one cities where there was a demand for real estate, finding such a huge project was a bit difficult. And tier two and three cities, you know, where such projects were available, there was not much demand. So industry demand is still 10,000, but yeah, it's a positive start. Apart from that, the government has also allocated 4,000 crores for National Housing Bank to come up with schemes to provide incentives or low-cost borrowing for affordable housing. So that is a major boost. I think this is going to, you know, incentivize the developers of low-cost housing and the sector itself. And third is they have also added low-cost housing, affordable housing, as a part of their 2% CSR. So now, you know, companies' profits can also use the revenue to utilize their 2% CSR spending. So I think these three are the major changes in terms of FDI.
And I think one more, and that
in terms of developers, if they are spending 30% of their project cost in low-cost housing or affordable housing, then even the requirement of 20,000 square meters is waived off. So that way, developer in tier one cities could also get FDI in such projects.
So you might have now SRAs, etc., where 30% cost is going, certainly free of any minimum area requirements and foreign money coming in.
Sure. So as we know, currently there are three Indian REITs which have been listed on SGX, S&R, Indiabulls, and Delhi Airs. My next question would be to Nitin, and you know, we'll, and maybe Richard, you can also add, and we'll open the floor for questions after that. Next question, so Nitin, the question to you is, do you think that as a foreign investor, he would be inclined to come to India and invest in Indian REIT, or he would be still better off investing in a Singapore REIT, which has underlying Indian assets?
Yeah. So, you know, in over last, like, sort of, I would say 5 years, various attempts have been made by various developers to list their assets in Singapore. We have found that there are practical challenges of listing Indian assets in say, exchanges like Singapore. So, practically speaking, even if investors were to, like, sort of invest in Indian assets in Singapore, I think we have found practical challenges in doing that. And there is significant cost is incurred by sponsors upfront in a sort of working out structure, which again we have found challenging. So, leaving aside the investor appetite issue, there are significant practical challenges. The other part is that what we have seen is typically the investors who are typically used to sort of investing through Singapore Stock Exchange, they are looking for constant yield, right, cash yield. And whereas what we have seen in India, because we have this corporate tax, we have dividend distribution tax, the ability of Indian assets to throw a regular cash yield is fairly limited. What Indian assets offer is growth, rental growth over the period and possible cap rate compression, given the fact that our interest rates are still very high and they're expected to come down in over the period. I think selling that story to global investors who are typically sort of investing through Singapore Stock Exchange is always an added element of complication. You know, you need to sell a whole sort of explanation to say that why you are offering lower cash yield vis-a-vis other assets which are available there. So I think we need to sort of bring those investors into Indian stock exchanges, and I think global investors who are investing in India, they have appetite for growth. They are not necessarily investing for cash yield only. So obviously REITs are meant to throw cash yield, but I think Indian REITs would have to offer a combination of yield and growth. Right, that's how the whole thing product will be workable. It goes to the fact that if you look at the pricing of REITs globally, typically the yields on REITs are at a premium to G-Sec yields, right? Whereas in India, if G-Sec are trading at 8.6, right, you cannot do cannot offer yields which are premium to G-Sec, right? I think there's a bit of different story which you need to grab around, you know, for selling Indian REITs. It's better that those guys come to India and sort of understand the whole story in one go, rather than telling it piecemeal to the few guys who are able to overcome those practical challenges.
Sure. I think just to add, Singapore versus Indian REIT, I think purely from a legal and regulatory perspective, just so that all of you understand, there is a Foreign Exchange Management Act. Within that, there are capital account transaction regulations, capital account transaction regulation lays the path to what we call as transfer and issue of securities to persons resident outside India. Schedule 1 of which is FDI, 2 is FII, etc. FDI and all that. The main regulations of capital account transactions, regulation 4B of those regulations, sets out certain prohibited sectors where no amount of direct or portfolio investment can happen. So even if you are FII or anything, you cannot have investments into completed assets. So it's a real estate business is a prohibited sector, right? Unless you are amongst one of the exempt classes, like hotels or hospitals or things like that. So because of that, if you're using a Singapore REIT, you only have two options. One is that you invest in developing assets. And the other option is for you to only choose from industrial parks, hotels, hospitals, etc. So I think your asset classes become severely limited. Second issue is from a GAR perspective,
once you have an offshore entity, a Singapore, you need to justify
that why have you set up this, or why have you set this entity up in Singapore, what is the reason, etc. So I think, let's see how GAR works. And third part will be the domestic institution pooling. Because if you set up a Singapore entity, then domestic institution pooling money or putting money offshore will be a huge challenge. So I think those will be three issues largely.
And I think that there's one other thing, and this is actually quite important considering what Nitin was mentioning, that what is the story that you're selling? The story that you're selling is that, well, our yields are not that high because our GSEC yields are obviously high. So you're effectively trying to sell a story where you're saying that there is going to be capital appreciation and future rental appreciation that's going to happen. And which is where I think what becomes critical is how are you structuring the REIT? Is the REIT directly going to hold the asset, or is the REIT going to hold the asset through a SPV? What would be, whether it should be thinly capitalized? Because you're now looking at a slightly different scenario where the interest coupon or the yield that's going to be coming out is not going to be that significant. So you're now going to try and structure something around how best, what is the most tax optimum situation if I'm looking at capital appreciation. So that becomes sort of critical in terms of REIT directly holding assets versus holding through a SPV with possibly a thin capitalization structure that's going to be there.
And we have seen in Delhi here, they also try to manufacture yields, right, by waiving their rights to take distribution in initial years. And that was not liked by the investors, right? So I think you don't have to, I think investors in Singapore particularly don't like manufacturing yields. So I think they have to come to India, appreciate the whole story of growth versus yield, and look at total returns over the period rather than only cash yields.
So, Richard, maybe the last question. I think a lot of participants would want to know what is the road ahead. What does SEBI need to do? What does Ministry of Finance need to do to ensure that the REIT regime takes off? Do you have any thoughts on that?
So I think one is purely from a SEBI perspective and a Securities Contract Regulation Act perspective. Units of a REIT need to be notified as securities in which people can invest. So that will probably happen. The another leg will be from a finance ministry perspective, where RBI will have to notify units of a REIT as a permissible security to invest under Schedule 5 for where FPIs, etc., can invest. Another leg will obviously be, as I was mentioning, that real estate businesses is prohibited. From that definition, investment in units of REIT is specifically being carved out, and we have RBI in principle approval on that. So I think those are a couple of things, but I think they should be underway. And I think these budget provisions should be effective from October 2014. And I think before that, all these changes would have come in.
Even the listing agreement and a lot of things need to be worked
out.
Yeah,
there has to be a listing agreement. In fact, it's quite funny because right now the delisting regulation here says that once you, upon any default, etc., the REIT gets delisted. And delisting currently is proposed to be as per SEBI current delisting norms, which forces the promoter to buy all the shares. Now, in a REIT, the delisting mechanism has to be completely different, where you liquidate the assets and distribute. So I think all that will take time, but I think it will come through.
Sure. So thanks a lot for your inputs. We'll now open the floor for questions. We can have a few questions from the audience here, and then we'll open up the... So maybe I think we can start with the questions for participants who are attending on phone.
Certainly, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and 1 on your touchtone telephone. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Anyone who has a question at this moment, please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. The first question is from the line of Atul from ILFS. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi sir, Atul here. Just a small query. The definition of real estate mentions that, you know, mortgage property is prohibited. So just wanted to check your views, like, you know, many real estate guys have mortgage properties. So is it not a roadblocker for them? Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll answer that. Yeah, so mortgage properties are not allowed, so you can't buy mortgage. The only within your 10% bracket also, you can only take mortgage-backed securities. And I think SEBI understand that the way ahead would probably be for mortgage-backed REITs, etc. But for now, this is only limited to mortgage-backed securities, that too in the 10% bracket.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Ashutosh Singh from Cushman and Wakefield. Please go ahead.
Sir, this is Ashutosh from Cushman and Wakefield. My question is there any minimum lock-in period during which the investor is required to invest in the REIT? And my second question is, how does this REIT has an implication on the FEMA? Are FEMA and the REIT interrelated anywhere?
I'll answer both your questions. On the investor, there is no lock-in. The only issue is that if you sell before 3 years, you would lose out on the tax benefits. And as regards FEMA and REITs, I think we just discussed that there will need to be a carve-out that needs to be made to allow units of a REIT allowed, and that is more from a foreign investor perspective.
And the only lock-in which is there is on the sponsor. So 25% of the units held by sponsors will be locked in for a period of 3 years from the date of listing, and anything above 25% will be locked in for a period of 1 year. So it can't happen that the sponsor transfers the property to the REIT, gets the unit, and on the next day transfers some of the units to public or to some other investor. So there is a lock-in for the sponsor, but not for the other unit holder.
Yeah, and also after the 3 years also, sponsor has to continually hold 15% of the total unit throughout.
At all times.
At all times.
Ms. Singh, are your questions answered?
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Ishan Singh from RE Capital. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. You know, I guess what I want to find is, what is the timeline for someone to undertake this process? And given the August group of people in this conference, who is the first person likely to be out of the gate? I mean, which is the first Indian entity who's going to list a REIT in India, and what is the timeline they're going to take to do it?
All right. We don't have astrologers on the panel.
No, but you have two commercial
engineers. I think you could probably answer on whom do you think should go, which developer, etc., who has been connecting with you. I think the timeline here should be a little lesser. Obviously, I think within 3-4 months, I think you should be able to obviously, subject to the regs, etc., coming out.
But considering that there's October limit before the end of the year, you should expect something.
Yeah, out. Yeah. On the commercial bit.
I'll try and answer it. But my guess is that there are only about 10 or 12 office developers, including DLF, Embassy, Panchil, I mentioned earlier, Prestige, etc., who have commercial assets on the balance sheet. Other than that, there are only two investors today who have large office portfolios. Blackstone and Brookfield. So my guess is it will be amongst these guys. One amongst these guys will lead the pack. But difficult to predict who's going to be the first.
I mean, yeah, I could see the Indian Express building as a first lead, a single asset. But you know, if people are putting as a meeting, it. I mean, so he's like Shobhit, like you just said. And I want to let's see someone go through this process once, and then you know, I guess it becomes clearer for everybody else.
Sure,
yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Any other next question, please?
Yes, sure. The next question is from the line of Gandharv Jain from AccuPro Consulting. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to understand that commercially, how this product is beneficial from a normal lease rental discounting. So we have a product of lease rental discounting in market, which is beneficial in terms of the developers to get funds from the market. So, how is it different?
So, I think Rajesh, you might want to answer this. See, we went to discuss. I think it'll again depend, as we said, where are your investor base, non-resident, resident, how are you capitalizing your REIT? So, I think Rajesh, you might want to.
There are two parts to it, right? One is the fact that over a period, there is a capital appreciation. So you effectively gotten the asset off your balance sheet. So, and then you can go on to your next project. So that's also, so there are certain commercial aspects to it, obviously in terms of what are the rates that you're getting between lease rental discounting vis-a-vis if you're actually putting it out in the lease. So I think you have to look at it as two different products. Each one is looking at a different investor class. In this particular instance, in case of REITs, you're probably focusing more around some of the Indian HNI family offices and anybody who's got deep pockets, and obviously a large pool of non-resident investors. So I would actually look at them as two separate products with two targets, two different commercial considerations, absolutely.
The fact is, you know, we have REITs, so basically what you're talking about is equity, right? And LRD is debt.
Correct.
So both are different.
Correct.
So when you take LRD, there's an obligation to repay, and repay over a period of time, where these units help them to sort of clean up their balance sheet, deleverage, and sort of move on and pursue growth. I think both are entirely different.
Permanent capital. Sort of permanent capital.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Johnny from Cambridge Associates. Please go ahead. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. Thank you very much for the in-depth explanation on REIT. One question regarding the current taxation structure. Is it still being debated, or is this pretty much finalized?
So this is really the budget proposal. There is a finance bill that has come out. The finance bill will obviously be tabled before the parliament and will be voted upon. There may be some degree of tweaks. Historically, what we have generally seen is that there may be some small minor tweaks to the finance bill before it gets placed for voting. But substantially, it will be similar to what we have in place, which we just explained, unless there is, let's say, a lot of representation and the government decides to change its stance on a couple of aspects, but you're more or less looking at what seems to be heading towards the final version.
Okay. It will be only an improvement over there.
It will be only an improvement. It can't get worse, that's for sure.
Sure. Looking from my perspective as an advisor to a number of, global LPs here, I mean, it seems that the only way that, somebody can optimize the tax is to, have some form of a debt instrument as the asset for the REIT. I mean, is that at all possible?
So I think I look at it in two forms. One is that if the REIT is holding the assets through a SPV, I would definitely be looking at a thin capitalization structure, whereby the REIT has substantially invested in debt and very little in equity, so that there is an absolute pass-through as far as the interest coupon is concerned, and you end up with only a 5% effective tax in India. Having said that, again, the question really is that when the capital appreciation aspect comes into play, holding the assets through the SPV, to what extent it is completely optimal is one question that's going to be there. If the REIT is directly holding the assets, you're effectively looking at what I would think at around a 21% tax in India on the rental yield, which is going to be directly distributed to the investors with no tax in India for the investors. So from a non-resident investor standpoint, they will probably get a credit for the 21% tax in India if the REIT is looked at as a pass-through entity. So from that perspective, there is some degree of tax optimization that can come into play for them. As I said, I think what becomes critical for a non-resident investor is whether in the home jurisdiction
they're going to look at the REIT as a pass-through entity or as a blocker entity. Because if it's a pass-through entity, once you have a 21% tax in India on the rental yields, which have already come in, there's not going to be that much of any significant tax consequence in the home jurisdiction.
So I guess it will be dependent upon the bilateral tax treaties that, you know, whoever the foreign country may be with India, correct?
And also the local laws of the jurisdiction from where the investor is invested.
That becomes critical, actually.
That would be more critical than the treaty.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Nitesh from BCRE India Private Limited. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. This is Nitesh. I have three questions, basically. The first is with respect to the sponsor, wherein a sponsor has a minimum obligation of a 15% holding in a REIT. Where is the REIT, the minimum value of assets that needs to be held at every time, is it going to be 1,000 CR only? That is number one. The second question is with respect to the yields. As per the GSEC yield rates prevalent in India, it's anywhere between 8.5 to 9 right now. It keeps on fluctuating. However, when you look at REITs which are listed outside and which are based out of India, whether it is FNDAS or Religare, those yields are anywhere in the range of 6 to 8. And you compare it to the prime yields in the market right now for prime income-generating assets, it's anywhere between 8 to 9. How can a REIT expect a premium on the prevailing GSEC yields? That's number two. The third question is with respect to the currency fluctuations that an NRI has to see over a longer period of time. I mean, on an average, on a year, if my dollar depreciates 8 to 10%, then how can I expect to make return on it when my yield is only 8 to 10%?
So I'll take the first question. The first question was on the 1,000 crores. So currently the way regulations are worded, draft regulations, they provide that at the time of IPO, the value of the REIT has to be only 1,000 crores. But I think the way SEBI looks at it is the value of the REIT going forward also at all times should be 1,000 crores. So that is the intention of the REIT. There should not be a small player. There should be only serious players who enter the REIT market. So I think that is the intention of SEBI.
I can take the second question. I think that's the point I was making, that Indian assets are able to sort of throw up only limited cash yield over the period, and investors have to look at the combination of cash yield and growth coming through rental and maybe through cap rate compression. Just to take off Ascenda's example, why they are offering 5.3% dividend yield in Singapore dollar in Singapore, the 3-year CAGR for Ascenda's India Trust is about 15%, right? Or rather 10% rather. So overall, the total return expectation over 3-year period is 15%. So I think that's the kind of rental growth which Ascenda is able to project. Whether they will be able to deliver or not, that's a separate issue. But you know, sort of, you have to sort of offer higher growth and hence meet the total return expectations of the investors.
Can you all take the question on exchange?
Okay, and exchange fluctuation, yeah, I think that's another issue of, you know, when you're trying to list your assets in Singapore, because people look at currency adjusted returns there. Investors who are used to like investing in Indian stock exchange, they have the mindset of taking currency risk. So they would be taking that currency risk and adjusting the return requirement. And I think the total return expectations which are being sought in rupee terms are basically set at a level which gives them some protection against currency devaluation.
But do you think that REIT would be able to provide us with that kind of returns? Now if I adjust it for currency risk, my institutional yields in the country right now is anywhere between 9 to 10, 10.5%. I adjust currency risk to it, my yield should jump up to around 11.5, 12%. Do you think that REITs would be able to provide those kind of yields?
Yeah, so I think the total return expectation based on our initial dialogue with investor community is about 13, 14% overall, which will be achieved through a combination of cash yield of about 6%, rental growth of about 4 to 6%, and balance through cap rate compression. All these three factors put together will give you 13-14% over the 5-7 year hold period. That should meet the return expectation of these long-term institutional investors. They are looking at 13-14% rupee return from Indian market.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Santosh Parab from IDFC. Please go ahead. Mr. Santosh Parab from IDFC, please go ahead with your question. There's no response. We take the next question from the line of Ashutosh Hegde from LIC Housing Finance Limited. Please go ahead.
Hi. Just wanted to check out, is there any restrictions on listing of SEZ properties?
No restriction.
Okay. Second question is that, is there any lock-in for the from the tenants, rental lock-ins for the tenants from income yielding assets? I mean,
no.
The way, like, for, as a fund, if you look at a property, you look at whether there's a 9-year lock-in or a 8-year lock-in or something of that sort. The tenant.
So there is no lock-in. There is no lock-in.
That's the manager's call or the company.
That you need
call.
To, but you need to ensure that as a REIT, 75% of your area is always leased out. Otherwise, you are in trouble from selling.
So what happens?
It will affect your marketing and pricing of the REIT.
Yeah. What happens after it is listed? 75%. I mean, 5%.
I think Rushil mentioned there's no cure at the moment.
So currently there is no cure period, but I think SEBI might was considering a 6-month cure. So let's see what comes out in the final weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question is from the line of Ketan Shah from Primary Advisors. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Just wanted to have clarification on this relaxation in FDI guidelines in terms of area and capitalization. Is it across all FDI investment or is it restricted to 100 smart cities?
It's across all.
I know that the budget statement, if you look at it, it said in order to build 100 smart cities, I am doing blah, blah, blah. But I think it is for everything. There is no specifically for the 100 smart cities that may or may not come up.
Yeah.
It's not for that.
It cannot be of 20,000 square meters.
Okay. Thank you.
The next question is from the line of Rajendra Prasad from Carvey. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Just wanted to understand what's the possible trading pattern like if for a small investor, a lot size 1 lakh and the minimum investment is 2 lakhs. That's for IPO. But once it comes down to the listing, what is how does that go about? Like, what's the expected liquidity and what is the tick size like, the trading unit?
No, ticket size has already been established at 1 lakh rupee per unit. The idea is that we did not want very small investors.
Okay.
At some point in time later, the ticket size may become smaller. But for now, it is 1 lakh only for trading and 2 lakh rupees for subscription.
So whenever you buy or sell even in the secondary market post listing, it has to be, will it be traded?
One unit.
Okay, so it has to be 1 unit or 1 lakh. So
yeah.
it's basically out of bounds for many retail investors. I mean, like,
that's the idea.
Yeah, okay. Any norms on liquidity, like as in how many number of units should be floated at least so that, the market is not clear?
Yeah. So basically, the minimum sponsor commitment of 25% is there.
And offer size has to be 50 crores. And what SEBI says is that minimum number of unit holders apart from sponsor has to be 20 at all times. So if it goes below 20, then you have to go for delisting.
And the public float has to be 25%.
Public float has to be 25% of the total unit.
Like, for example, when it comes to capital appreciation, as you said, it will be valued only 2 times in a year and 1 time fully.
Correct.
So the valuation that you do will be based on the discounted cash flow methodologies, or will the valuers are there any guidelines on valuation techniques or methodologies?
So there are internationally accepted methodologies or ICI prescribed methodology. ICI prescribed methodology will prevail over any other methodology. So I think that we've discussed. Maybe we can.
And the NAV, unlike the RMF, will be calculated twice, which the manager will have to do twice in a year.
And sir, any capital gains that we have, how will be the taxation for that? Will it be a pass-through or?
There is no pass-through as far as capital gains are concerned. It's going to be taxed in the hands of the REIT, but there is not going to be any tax in the hands of the investors at the time of distribution.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the tax rate like for the REITs? It's a usual listed securities capital gains.
It will be like the usual listed units that are there. The only thing is that the holding period is 3 years.
So it will be, what will be the capital gains tax long term?
Zero. Long term will be zero, except for the sponsor who unfortunately has to pay higher tax.
Okay.
All right.
So maybe I think we can open the floor for the audience.
Can we just check how many on the phone?
Are there more questions?
No.
Participant joining on phone?
Okay, no, there's no one.
Okay, great. So maybe we can have questions from
you. In the case where the assets are transferred to the REIT directly, is there any exemption or refund stamp duty?
No.
You have to pay fully.
See, stamp duty is a state subject. So that's why it's not possible to convince so many states. They are anyway grappling with GST to convince all.
Unless states actually come up with specific exemptions to.
Unless states come up
all over the rate.
The form of the SPV, can it be an LLP or it has to be a company? Because it's a foreign investment going into a...
Currently, as things stand, LLP, because of the way the LLP legislation is worded, you can only have a body, you can only have, let's say, a body corporate as a member. REIT, there is a gray area as to whether REIT qualifies as a body corporate based on the status of the trustee. So I think what people are looking at generally is that at this point in time, you're only looking at companies.
And suppose the manager is already a manager of a mutual fund, of a AMC, or a manager of a AIF, manager of a VCF. Can he simultaneously play the role of a manager?
Should be possible, because there is a specific provision under REIT regulation where they mention the manager should link his activities of REIT versus his other activities. So in the same entity, you can house multiple activities. But obviously, you will have to also look at other regulations. Like in mutual fund, there are certain requirements where you need to go to SEBI to get an approval to do other activities.
Suppose if a private equity fund who owns a commercial asset, he plans to kind of throw the asset into the pool of real estate. Now this 15% holding for the fund. Now fund may have a limited life of 7-10 years. How would this work?
Yeah. So basically, one is whether he is designated as a sponsor or not. So if he is designated as a sponsor, which will be if he is throwing the asset into the pool, the requirement is 15%. If there is a change in sponsor, 75% of the unit holders have to approve first. And if the unit holders do not approve, the new designated sponsor. So whenever there is a transfer, the sponsor will have to redesignate the new person as the redesignated sponsor. Redesignated sponsor will have to give an option to the unit holders to sell the units back to the redesignated sponsor. So they give an exit option to the unit holders.
Well, the other way can be, as Shobhit was mentioning, that the PE fund partners with that developer. And the developer is recognized as the sponsor who continues to hold it. And then the PE firm is free to transfer, etc.
But there is a provision for transfer to another sponsor. So if your fund life is ending, then before the end of fund life, you can find another fund which has just started its life, and you know it can buy the.
The
REIT is expected to pay 90% of its income as a payout to the investor. I presume it will be a net income.
Yes.
So is there any cap on what type of expenditure REIT can debit to the gross income?
So this was discussed. And ultimately, it was decided that there should be no cap that should be prescribed. But, and that is why there is obligation on the manager and the trustee to supervise that. And everything should be in legitimate arm's length. It's kept at arm's length. Now, what is arm's length?
There's global practices all around, this kind of income stream or cost structures are already prevalent. So I don't think anybody can now come back and say, I have a chart, a half it number.
Super normal.
So my sense is that it's not going to be a money making.
Typically, what percentage it works, etc.
I followed Ascender. I think the leakage is about 1.5%.
2-3% is typically.
Yeah. Just on the direct expenses, and then of course there are.
And interestingly,
excluding the fees,
the 90% requirement in a lot of jurisdictions is only for getting a tax pass-through. In India, what SEBI has done is it is a mandatory condition for it to retain its characteristics, character as a REIT.
So in other jurisdictions, they can still retain the money deployed for assets, but in India, mandatorily you have to distribute it to the unit.
Whether this real estate SPV has to necessarily own the asset, or it can own a, it can have a lease asset itself, and then it can do. So if I'm a
leasehold is specifically allowed. So there's a specific provision in the pre-trend.
So now, so if I'm a real estate developer and I have say 10 associates, I can take on lease 10 properties worth 1,000 crores, and then you know list my company and you do it.
So I'll tell you. The leasehold asset has been allowed, but the intent of SEBI is not that you have a 1 year or a 2 year lease or a 3 year lease. These are intended to be long term leases because many times, like in BKC, etc., assets, the properties itself are on leasehold leases. So it's only as a substitute to conveyance that leasehold has been allowed.
But a leasehold title, not a leasehold property.
Correct.
It's a leasehold title. Land can be leasehold, but the property has to be owned.
Yeah, it's a leasehold title, which means. Sometimes when you're dealing with the government, the title can only be leasehold.
Correct.
They cannot give you a freehold title.
I think it's difficult to put it like a short term, even 10 year leases into a portfolio and list that.
Yeah, you're very challenging. You're barring again.
I'm not talking about challenges on account of investor facility, but I'm talking about from the
regulatory perspective. The intent of SEBI was not to allow leased assets. It was really because some assets will always be inherently leasehold. It was for that purpose that the provision of leasehold was added.
In fact, the definition of real estate specifically says means land and other attached improvement, whether leasehold or freehold, and includes buildings, fittings, fixtures, and other assets incidental to ownership of real estate. So your structure has to be owned, your land can be leasehold.
And to keep a check, manager has to, when he is acquiring leasehold property, he has to give a report to trustee, has to know what is the remaining period of leasehold, all those.
That
is
quite stringent. So you should just where you can't own it, it is only in those cases. So otherwise,
yield
is not the idea.
Yeah. Coming back to the earlier question where we are talking about distribution of 90% of proceeds income and also the limitation that the REIT has to be a 1,000 crore entity throughout its life, it essentially means I cannot sell the property at any point in time. Because the moment I've sold or passed on the property, the income gets distributed, it goes below the 1,000.
You can be more than 1,000.
Provided I go there. If I've grown that
value.
And given this limitation, the growth as well as yield story does not exist. So, any comments on that?
See, what we are saying is from the initial portfolio of 1,000 crore, there will be growth. Growth on account of growth in rental, and maybe a sort of capital compression which will improve your capital value. That anyway will come through, and total return expectation of the investors can be met through that.
Okay.
What we're talking about, sort of a growth in the portfolio, which will help, and investors are looking at growth as well, growth of the overall portfolio, right? Because your acquisition should be yield accretive, right? Or return accretive. So hopefully that will help in sort of meeting the overall return expectation of the investor. Obviously, no investor
to grow.
Yeah.
In terms of its AUM.
So typically the REITs are meant to grow over the period, right? If you say, no, my REIT is going to be static for long period, again, from marketing perspective, there will be an issue.
Just commercially speaking, you know, if you're talking about 1,000 crores, we have...
You're talking about 3-4 buildings.
Not even, maybe two buildings. So I think the restriction has come from, people trying to list out single assets. Right. And this, just from an exit perspective and keep control.
There will be a lot of entrepreneurs in this
market. Any of these 100 million that we were talking about, I think minimum size would be 6-7 million square feet per listing, right?
Okay.
It could be even higher, double digits. I don't think we'll ever be in that situation that we'll be trying to meet the minimum criteria. There's something really wrong if you're trying to be that 1,000 crores and 250 crores of costing at the very minimum.
So here's a question. When you're pricing the REIT at the initial listing time, when you're talking about rental growth, incremental rental growth on an annual basis or every 3 year resets that happen here typically. When you're pricing it at the time of IPO, aren't you factoring in all of those with the current existing leases in place that you're discounting it to the NPV and you're deciding what is the value? So where is the increment coming out? There is only a cap rate compression possibility unless you are pricing it at the today's rental only without actually factoring in the future lease, increase in the leases, and why would a developer not do it when he has a signed letter which resets incremental rent every 3 years?
We have to differentiate between the yield and the valuation, right? So So one is the cash yield we were discussing, and we are saying that the total return expectation will be met partly through cash yield and partly through growth, right?
Yeah.
So valuation will obviously take into account the future growth,
yeah,
right? So that will be captured in the valuation computation. What I'm saying is that when you compute the, when you buy the asset, you will look at what kind of total return I'll make over the period, capturing the inherent growth.
The individual subscriber to the REIT?
Right,
not sponsor is the actual owner of the REIT. Let's assume that it's a developer. Already owns it. So are you talking about him? Because he already knows what is there in it.
Right.
Are you referring to the subscriber to the REIT? Investor like myself?
Yeah, so if you're subscribing, right? So
yeah.
What will happen is, suppose at the time of IPO, the REIT will say, fine, I'll offer you 6% cash yield, right? And you know that because of the leases which have already been entered into, it will give you 4 to 6% rental growth, right? So next year, the yield on your investment price will not be 6%. It will be 6%.
It will not be next year. It will happen only after 3 years. It doesn't every year in typical leases in
that's
India.
Fine, that's fine.
Every
year will be 15%, right? So there will be like a one-time jump. And that will impact both the impact the cash yield as well as impact the capital value. Because once you have arrived at a cap rate, you'll apply cap rate on the NOI, which would be at an escalated number.
Adip, just to answer it differently, you're assuming that everything that's listed is rented day zero. Right? So that's
so
not going to happen.
75% of the property.
Yeah,
is
so you're going to have a staggering of even the increments on rent. So it will happen, number one. Number two
I take your point also. So sorry to cut you, but the thing is, I agree that everything is not listed on day zero. But then, there will be small portions, and those will be trickles. Everything is not also listed like floor-wise or 25%, 20% on the same dates in every year, right? There could be staggering of 3 months, 6 months on every lease.
Yeah.
So yeah, it will come in trickles. So it's not an absolute number that will happen every year or every exact reset of the 31st
April.
But you
know that on day zero.
I agree. My question was slightly different. The question is, as a developer, as a sponsor who owns this 1,000 crore rupee asset, how am I pricing it? Am I pricing it on today's rental only? Because as a developer, will I not like to look at where I've been cashing it? And supposing over a period of time, minimum is 25%. I may want my cash requirement to be 75% listing. I may list the 750 crore of note and I own 250 crore worth. I tend to lose, vis-a-vis, there was a question earlier also, vis-a-vis rental discounting or a large individual investor who's buying from me at today's 10%, who is pricing that 9-year increases today and giving me the money?
No, so even when you buy these assets, it will not be priced on the year zero rental, right? You'll build a 20-year model and see what kind of returns.
You can't build 20-year models in India. Sorry,
so I think
nobody has done it historically. So let's say 10 years. That is what is real in
10 years,
today.
20 years, whatever it is. Like so when I say 20 years, basically that's a long-term horizon. So basically, you look at 10 years and you look at what kind of returns the assets will generate, and accordingly you price it.
Okay. Even on the private side, even where you have long-term contracts, right? In India, typically your lease contracts are 9 years.
Yes.
There are either unleased areas or after the lock-in, you assume there will be a re-rating because the tenants will shift.
Yes.
It is not necessary that your rental for 9 years is predetermined.
So vacancy risk, all the
vacancy risk, re-rating risk is there, and therefore you assume there will be some growth. So my sense is that you can. And when you have a variety of portfolios or different buildings, it's in fact that risk is reduced. And therefore, listing a portfolio, this question will not be asked. But yeah, if it's a single asset, then I'll be challenged.
I mean, there is an asset very close to where we are sitting, which is 1,200 crore rupee asset. It's a single asset.
Yeah, it's a single asset. Single asset, you'll have an issue.
You list that,
but yeah.
You have an issue on that.
But like
you qualify
like
under
said,
all parameters, but you can face that issue.
Therefore, the unit price will fluctuate every day.
Half yearly.
Half yearly.
Because at any point, 75% is anywhere leased. You can't have less than 75% leased.
So
the variation will only be 25%.
If I am a unit holder who has acquired a property in, say, a BKC. Not BKC, now upcoming suburban. Now, all of a sudden, the area has changed and everything. Value of the property is appreciated from say 1,000 crore to 2,000 crore in a year's time. So the entire game will change. The lease rental may not be, changing in terms of the.
It should get reflected in the pricing of the.
So
then
the value of the unit will change, right?
Yeah.
Value
will change.
That is why you have to add two valuations. Not a daily NAV, but you have. Because property value does not change every day.
Hmm.
But yeah, over a period of time, over 6 months, you will change your life.
So the investor will be able to exit only in six months. So it's
The valuation will be reset every 6 months.
Every 6 months.
So for a 6 month period, you take a call.
And you can add more assets to the same listed REIT?
Yeah, you
keep on adding. So then here's the question from tax angle. Because if you intend to do that for large developers, also who will have continuous flow of such assets, what would be your recommendation from a tax perspective? Should they look at putting structures of SPV, ownership by REIT, or shares of REIT from a long-term view to have the best taxation structure so that investors are benefited?
So there's 2 points there, right? And the question is who's getting benefited? That's as to whether it's the sponsor or the investor.
I think it's very responsible.
So from a sponsor hat, if I look at it, obviously, if my call is that there is going to be a future appreciation, I don't, subject to obviously cash flow and everything, I may even consider can I transfer today and pay tax at today's value, but I'll get the capital appreciation at the later point in time. I get the step up in basis and all of that. That's one call that they can take. The second call is that transferring the asset directly into the REIT versus transferring shares of the SPV that will be there. And here you need to look at it from two perspectives, actually. You cannot just look at it from sponsor, because ultimately the question is, is the REIT marketable or not? Ideally, my ideal situation is always if I'm having a SPV, REIT should be having a thin cap structure, which means that there is only, let's say, a 10% equity, rest of it is debt. So if I can manage, if a sponsor has already set up a SPV today for, let's say, a lot of enough development around, so if the current SPV structure already enables that, then it is easy for me to actually transfer that out into the SPV. Otherwise, there has to be some degree of restructuring that needs to be done if I'm transferring it, the SPV, or post-transfer I have to do some degree of restructuring to get to my ideal structure, which will benefit the investors also. Because if I don't give enough on the table for the investors, they're not going to pick it up. The third thing is, okay, do I transfer the asset directly into the REIT? Well, in some cases, obviously, the sponsor is holding the assets directly. Because otherwise I have dual incidence of stamp duty. If I transfer it into a SPV and then transfer it out, I have enough stamp duty issues which I have to think about. So from a cost perspective, it doesn't make sense for him, but to transfer it directly into the REIT as the asset. So that's broadly when I'm looking at it from the sponsor perspective. So as I said, there are two calls that are there. One is that can the sponsor take the position that the settlement of the property or the asset should not be taxable under the general trust law provision, rather than relying on the specific exemption which they have given. Because in that case, then when he is subsequently selling it, he gets the capital gains tax, the long-term capital gains tax exemption. That is one call that is there. From an investor standpoint, when I look at it, is the investor better off with the REIT holding the assets directly or the REIT holding it through the SPV? In most cases, as in just a back of the math envelope calculation seems to indicate that in all probability, if you have a whole bunch of non-resident investors, you're probably better off holding the assets directly. If you're having resident investors as your target class, then I'll probably look at the thin cap structure, the SPV structure also working out. So to a large extent, it depends on who my target audience is when I'm marketing the REIT. And depending on that, I'll sort of work out on the structure that would probably be appropriate. Because even for non-resident investor, I have to see where are they going to be coming from. Are they coming from Singapore? Are they coming from US? Am I marketing it to Japanese investors? It depends. Because each one, because you're looking at an animal, when I talk about the REIT, as to each jurisdiction, we'll look at the Indian REIT difference. So I need to look at it from that perspective as to who am I marketing it to? Who are the people who are going to want to invest here? And depending on that, I have to do the structuring, whether holding it directly with our system.
So I think we can take any more questions offline.
What is the liquidating provision in another REIT? And
what are the provision when you have to incur major repair and maintenance for a building of, for say 10-15 years? You have to renovate the entire thing. So from where the funds will come and how you will organize it?
So, what is the first part of the question? So, in terms of leverage, 25% the REIT can take without approval, up to 25% of the total value of the REIT. Beyond 25%, if they want to take, they can go up to 50%, subject to unit holder consent and credit rating. So, that is in terms of leverage. Now, the second question is maintenance. Obviously, one is from the lease rentals, if there is sufficient, they can use also the lease rentals.
From the reserves.
Reserve the kind that you like.
Exactly.
You'll
keep a reserve account.
And by the way, first time that they've been generous enough to say ECB will be allowed for REITs. So you can get very cheap leverage from offshore. But that's budget sake. I don't know what guidelines the RBI prescribe and what conditionalities it come with. So that's another source other than your accrual.
So in last question, I mean, in terms of it, what 99% of the developers in India who are, you know, who has a property on lease will not be, you know, they would have not leveraged it. I mean, you cannot have a developer who has not leveraged the property. So then, can I just not the REIT infuse the money into that SPV rather than shared getting transferred and asset getting transferred, infuse the money in the SPV, the debt getting repaid?
No, absolutely.
So then, for that
absolutely
period.
So this is what we discussed, right? That to tax optimize, one of the ways could be for you to inject debt. If you have existing debt, you retire that debt. If the sponsor wants money somewhere, then you retire equity to a cap reduction. So there are different models. But clearly, debt is one of the best ways. Because then that's the only way of pass through, and that too at a 5% optimized tax rate.
The question is, therefore, that for a limited period, that mortgage may asset. So if the asset is mortgage, can there be any degree of
No. So that is fine. Your asset can have certain amount of loan on that. Right? That is okay. They have prohibited is that you cannot only buy, mortgage-backed securities or only mortgages. Your asset can obviously have mortgage so long as you're within the overall 25% even on a pass-through basis. It's fine.
So the utilization of the proceeds, you will anyways mention that the funds raised by the REIT will be used to retire the bank debt.
So if I have taken a lease rental discounting today, from the standard chartered bank, I can just take the money, increase the money, make money, and pay that bank and
yeah.
Okay, that would probably be the most common. This will close the panel, and thanks to all the panelists for your valuable insights and to the audience for the interactive discussion.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.